Off the ball on News Talk.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.
Welcome back. We're reviewing the Sunday papers. We're streaming on Facebook. We're live here in the radio as well. You're very welcome. We have Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner here and Kieran Cunningham as well from the Irish Daily Star. Lads, you're both very welcome. The headlines then, it's all about the game at the Aviva last night, really, as you can imagine. Picture of Martin O'Neill screaming onto the pitch. Den, as in D-E-N, Denmark. Den, there was one. O'Neill desperately needs win over Wales to save his job, reckons the Sunday World. Roy Curtis writing here. The one being the game against Wales. Ryan Giggs pictured inside. Sunday Mirror. Probably captured the general mood, I think. Mundane. D-A-N-E. Mundane. Highlighted. Dour draw, part of a crucial rebuilding period, says Irish boss. Sunday Independent. Go with a picture from last night. Picture of Duffy looking for that penalty. And the headline is Point Made. And inside there, O'Neill insists progress is being made after Dour draw gives Ireland first Nations League point. Ireland managing just one shot, Colin Young points out, on target. Three in total as they held an equally poor Denmark team in persistent rain last night. Then we have the Mail on Sunday. O'Neill makes a point. Manager hailed stalemate as a platform for the Irish rebuilding project. And picture of Cyrus Christie, who played in central midfield last night for the first time since he was 14 years of age, he was saying afterwards. The Sunday Times have a picture of McLean getting involved with Danish players after, I think, what looks like the Jeff Hendrick moment. You would have seen McLean went over and got involved. Fighting draw, Republic dig out first point of Euro campaign, but can't find a goal. And then an interesting story on the right-hand side of the front page of the Sunday Times. Eden Hazard says he feels pretty guilty about that season where he downed tools for Jose Mourinho. He's done an interview and says, I feel guilty. That was a season where he didn't score a goal until April, which is kind of unthinkable, really. And he said, I sent him a message, sent Jose a message to say I was sorry he'd gone and that I was sorry. And he was asked now, would he play for Jose again? He said, if I'm asked now about one coach who I'd like to work for again, it's Jose Mourinho. It's a big turnaround from Eden Hazard. The Sun then have a picture of Jeff Hendrick, I think just after he's shot wide with his moment in and goal. We might have let them score. This is O'Neill who's saying they may have had to consider letting Denmark score if Jeff Hendrick had taken that chance. And then finally, the Star, drawing board. So back to the drawing board, and also it was a boring draw. The play there in the Star, winless run goes on. And James McLean reckons Ireland are back on track, he says, even though their winless run continues. So, as ever, the Irish football team, if they're playing, it's the back page news, it's the big news. There's various pieces inside, from Stephen Hunt to Kevin Moran, and then various reporters at the game. What is the general mood out there?
It's funny.
That sigh alone is kind of the general mood.
It's deja vu all over again, as somebody once said, but it is Groundhog Day. And one thing that strikes me, Joe, is, like, you went through a lot of it there, and we have a list of various pieces about the game that we might get to in the next few minutes. But so there's thousands of words being written. I'm curious how much has actually been read. Like, what's the appetite out there for people to read about that 0-0 draw, which was utterly forgettable and really pretty dismal? Because this was very striking. Now, somebody told me this last week. After the Wales game, the hammering against Wales in Cardiff and the opening UEFA Nation League game, there's two big sales days for daily newspapers, Saturday and Monday, and that's down to sports coverage. Monday, September the 10th, right, was after the Wales game and the building up towards the Poland friendly. The day before was the Camogie final. There wasn't much else on the GA front other than some club championship games, etc. Obviously, no Premier League. It was the lowest Monday sale on record ever for newspapers in Ireland. And I think that's kind of telling about where the national team is at the moment, that interest is dipping. You know, I think people are still watching the games on TV, but I wonder, are they reading about it as much? Are they listening to the discussion over the course of a week on your show, for example, to the same extent as they were? I think they are getting detached from it. And it was interesting last night, like, when one of the many lulls during the game, I had a quick look at the hashtag, the Ireland-Denmark hashtag, and looked through it. There was so much negativity there. There wasn't a single positive comment, and a lot of anger and a lot of frustration. And I think it's only going one way. I think it's going to get worse.
Even beyond O'Neill's tenure?
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you look at the pattern, you know, how, going on how many Irish players are with Premier League clubs and how many are starting, year on year has gone down.
Yeah.
It's not going to go back up again. I can't see it unless they come up with a new model, a new pathway for creating decent quality players, and that would take huge investment in the domestic game, which I can't see ever happening. I think it's in big, big trouble here.
They're hoping these academies at the League of Ireland clubs really start to pay off. What's your feel on that point?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. There's still seven Premier League players who started last night, but I take Kieran's point. I think everything he said is quite true. I think it was Mick Foley today described the Irish football team as the sick man of Irish sport, which is a great little phrase to use. And it's definitely there. And the most really alarming thing for me is the difference in what most people saw and what people inside the camp are seeing themselves. Now, maybe this is something you have to do in professional sport, but it really worries me that they do think player after player last night came out into the mix zone, talked about a positive game, positive football, we played some good stuff, we could have nicked
track.
A win.
Yeah.
And you're just thinking, look, I understand, I mean, somebody again, it might have been Mick, was talking about it being a nervous breakdown in those two games when they conceded 9 goals. So there is an element of consolidation. Okay, let's batten down the hatches. But it's still, regardless of the circumstances, that the absence of ambition and tempo from an Irish team. There was one instance last night in the first half. James McLean got the ball down towards the left corner flag at the Danish end. And he had a simple 5 metre slide rule pass to play to Jeff Hendrick, who was kind of running in around the defender. And it was like a golfer with the yips. He was so tentative playing the pass. It was such a basic pass. I could have played. It was like any pass we've all played in five-a-side football on a Monday night. And he completely just didn't connect with it. And it just spoke to me. And there was another instance in the second half with a short free routine, everybody remember, down the right to Cyrus Christie. Mm. And it just screamed of tentativeness and... Yeah. Just a team that is unable to express itself, and that comes from the top.
Yeah.
So the players are at a level, like you say, Kieran.
Yeah.
But when it's coming from the management that we don't have players and we don't do this, they're set up, the tempo as well. Every time there was a break in play and Ireland got a throw or a free, everything stopped.
Yeah.
It was like a game of rugby, wasn't it? Okay, everybody stop, get into your positions, formulaic, and let's do what we can. Yeah. If it's not set pieces, we don't have a clue.
Yeah, no, that's very valid. What Brendan is saying, that even though you can quibble about the quality of players, they're underachieving at the same time. Where at international football, so many goals come from throw-ins, free kicks, corner kicks. And we are so slow and laboured and lethargic and take it. Like you give the opposition the time to get organised. Mm. You look how slow we are to press down opponents when they have the ball and how much space to give them to play around. And it's actually very stark as well how quickly things have changed. Like November 2016, Ireland won in Vienna. It was the first time they'd ever beaten Austria away from home, and the first time they'd beaten Austria since 1963. That's less than 2 years ago. And that was the same year where they'd beaten Italy at the Euros. It was the year after beating world champions Germany. Ireland had played 10 competitive games since then. They've only won two of them. And one of those was against Moldova. And the other one was against Wales, where they rode their luck for long periods. And there's a very stark stat now. There's 6 games this year Ireland have played. And one of those was against USA, and they had 5 shots on target. And the other 5 games, they had 7 shots on target in total. Mm. That's not 7 goals, 7 shots on target in 5 games.
Question for you. Who set up the goal in Vienna? Who scored against Sweden? Who set up the winning goal against Italy?
Wes.
And he's gone. He was a shining beacon.
Wes papered over a lot of cracks.
He did,
100%. Yeah.
So Eamon Sweeney here says, relief a draw tells us how far we've fallen. And he says, like all draws, this one posed the old glass half empty versus half full conundrum. Talked about it, felt like a game against Germany, where we went, you know, surrendered territory and it was about containment, except this opposition didn't merit such an awestruck struck stance. And then he makes this point, which I think is a good one. The draw does not so much take the pressure off Martin O'Neill's shoulders as place further emphasis on Tuesday's match. The poverty of Ireland's approach makes a mockery of predictions that a more adventurous philosophy might be adopted. Win against Wales and the tedium of last night can be justified as necessary to restore confidence. Lose or draw, and this will have been a very depressing few days. Mm. Kevin Moran in the Sunday World, he says, last night's Ireland performance would have been quite acceptable if the match was played in Copenhagen. you know, away from home, keep it tight, make a chance somewhere. Trouble was, we were in Dublin at home, supposed to set the terms of engagement, and the fact is we never did. He says, I am just really disappointed by our midfield play these days. We never tried to hold the ball, to create, to pass. So that's Kevin Moran, and he even makes the point as well. There were times last night when James McLean was right on top of the three centre halves. If I was playing in that formation, I'd have been roaring at James to get out there. I'd have been shouting, there's three of us here big enough, we can deal with it. You get further up the pitch so we can give you the ball and we win it back. He says, maybe it's Martin O'Neill doesn't believe we have the players. And he says, we're relying on a set piece to do the trick. And then when Brady's not there, it's a very ropey strategy. So he says, with the turnaround now, there'll be, you know, a day for the subs to get a bit of a run out on Monday. So against Wales, it's going to be more of the same. We'll just do our best to get a goal from somewhere and stay alive in the competition. So that's a good summation of, I think, the general disheartenment that people feel.
You could go further with the management as well. They've gone back to a 3-5-2. They've played 4-4-2. You had Cyrus Christie playing central midfield. James McLean playing at the back, which clearly doesn't suit him. Mm. You have Jeff Hendrick talking in the papers today. There's been a lot of criticism about Jeff Hendrick post the Euros in 2016. And he makes a very valid point that he's been played all over the park.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the management doing in a long-term view, even for themselves?
Yeah.
I mean, Martin O'Neill has spoken in the past about, well, it's no good to me if there's a 16-year-old, like, as we saw Troy Parrott scoring a hat-trick yesterday. That's no good to me and long-term academy plans and everything. But what is he doing for the medium term for his team? Mm.
Yeah.
Like, where is the structure?
If Jeff Hendrick is given a load of different positions to play in, and from all we know of the way Martin O'Neill approaches the job, he's told very close to kickoff where he's playing.
Well, I hope Cyrus Christie found out during the week. Mm. We'll have to see.
But like you interviewed Martin O'Neill in Aberdeen, you asked him about this, and he did confirm that he tells people shortly before kickoff, didn't he? From what I remember,
yeah. Brian Clough did it. He was a good manager. Worked for him.
Brian Clough was managing Forest before you were born.
I mean, I often think if Brian Clough had turned around to O'Neill and said, "But Martin, this is what they did in the 30s," O'Neill would have told him where to go. Mm. O'Neill basically said in that interview, "Yeah, I do leave it late. Keeps people on their toes." And he also said, some of the players don't want to know they're starting. They'll be nervous the night before.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think 26-year-old Jeff Hendrick is going to lose sleep over a Denmark game if he knows he's starting.
And Kieran has touched on it about international football, and Miguel Delaney writes about it a lot in The Independent and others. It's very, very basic. It's not a great standard, a lot of it. Yeah. Organisation and structure and knowing what you're about. That's what Giovanni Trapattoni did well when they were doing well.
Yeah.
And I suppose like Trapattoni as well, he'd always have it 4-4-2. And, you know, really, he had his players in the position they were used to playing in. Now we have this thing, different formations, and people have been moved around all the time.
I mean, a broadcaster's nightmare these days, genuinely, is when Martin O'Neill names the team an hour before kickoff and you only get 30 seconds of an ad break to glance at it. Who would have predicted the formation last night when they saw the players? Nobody. Jeff Hendrick, by the way, says, when you look back to the Euros, this is in various pieces. David Snaid's written it up, and it's Paul Rowan here in the Sunday Times. When you look at the Euros, I was one of the advanced two in a three-man midfield, and I've probably not played that much since. I played off the right a lot more for the World Cup qualifiers. It's harder to affect the game from that position. People don't take that into account when they're judging me. And then he says, he makes an interesting point as well. Roy Keane talked about crybabies a few weeks ago, and Hendrick's had a bit of a nibble back. He says every player's big hurdles throughout their career. It's a silly comment for people to say that they don't care, that we're soft. They've had to leave their families at 15, go away, be a professional footballer. He says fans have a lot more access social media wise. Every player gets abused. That's just the way it is. Interestingly, Rowan adds that in this piece, Keane, it seems, is adopting an arm around the approach shoulder with the midfielder. He sat down with Hendrick in front of the DVD to analyse his ineffective performance against Wales. So he says, he didn't say much about what Keane said to him. He says, in fairness to Wales, they were very good. Whether we helped them look that good, I don't know. But it seems Keane is sitting down with him and trying to improve him. I mean, if Roy Keane can't help a midfielder along, then we're in big trouble. Stephen Hunt was the voice of
very
positivity,
positive,
wasn't he?
A lot of positives, he ends up saying. Said they started off very well, which amounted to 60 seconds of maybe good stuff at the start of it.
Shane Ross was very impressed with the passing.
Exactly. That man doesn't know about football, who does?
He tweeted that the passing was very good and we should not discount
that. Shane Ross, our massive social media team, they're probably passing the book with each tweet. It wasn't me, it was the other fellow.
Talk about them generally, Shane. Don't name names though. No names, whatever you do, is the advice. But sorry, Stephen Hunt.
Yeah, and again, look, I mean, one thing that he says that I do agree with and everybody agreed with was Callum Robinson's introduction. Yeah. And we were talking about it. That's what Ireland do well, you know, get at them a little bit. And that coincided with the one time in the game where they actually strung a few passes together and we had Cyrus Christie's shot and goal. It's not rocket science.
It's not. And it's funny, like, but I was thinking, if you were in Callum Robinson's position watching that from the bench, you would think, if I get on here, I have a chance.
Because
if I just show a bit of energy and bite, you're going to stand out, because everybody else is just strolling around the place.
Yeah.
He says, interestingly, Hunt says at one point, I felt the team were playing for this manager last night. Often teams give up with 20 minutes to go and they switch off. Ireland did not do that. And that, for me, is a sign that all is well with the manager. So that's an interesting professional.
That's one way of looking at it. Yeah. The other way of looking at it is Denmark thought, we've job done. It's up to you guys to get the win. Yeah. Draw is fine with us. Yeah. No, that's the way I'd look at it.
Robinson certainly helped. So he came on in 65 minutes and changed things. Interestingly, Hunt says as well, Shane Long was Ireland's best player for a lot of the game. Enthusiastic, determined, needed better ball. Anything he did well. He was isolated, but you could see he was trying his heart out. He was hungry, wanted to win back his number 9 shirt.
Yeah, because I've often wondered, I'd love to see that stat broken down by someone, since that goal against Germany, that beat Germany 3 years ago, how many chances has he had? Actual shots, not let alone goals. He's just chasing lost causes all the time.
So there we are. That's the Irish coverage in the papers today. What are you saying? Who wouldn't want to dig into all that, Ciarán, and read all that goodness?
Well, make sure to read the daily papers
tomorrow. Make sure to read all the stuff we've read about tomorrow as well.
The rugby obviously features pretty heavily as well, so we might just touch briefly on the opening weekend. So you've Neil Francis and Lawrence Dallaglio writing about Leinster. Dallaglio likens them to the All Blacks.
They're
with BT Sport alongside Brian O'Driscoll on Friday night.
Because it's interesting that, like, Neil Francis is Neil saying that they actually messed up 8 try-scoring opportunities. Yeah. They could have scored 50-60 tries.
I'd go along with that. I think that's a really scary thing about Leinster. It took them 40 minutes to get into their stride.
And their set piece wasn't great for the first half. I mean, even Leo Cullen mentioned a few line-outs and a few scrums, and they still win 52 points to 3. So work that one out. Francis opens with the Marvin Hagler line. It's very hard to get out of bed and pound the roads at 5 a.m. in the morning when you're wearing silk pyjamas, as you'd know, Brendan. But he says, like, for Leinster, it's really the battles against themselves this year. They're by a distance the best team in the tournament, so can they keep it going? Interestingly, he says, their opening night defence against Wasps, defence of their title, not their defence, their opening night defence against Wasps did not help their cause. As in, it'll be even harder for them now to look around at each other and say, well, OK, a few things were creaky in the first half maybe, but we still won by 52 points to 3. Aren't we deadly?
Tadhg Furlong, that's mentioned in one of the pieces today, was asked about it recently. How did they defend their title? And he said, we attack it.
A few of them have said that.
That's a good kind of, you know, it's a little bit corny, but I like it as well. You know, the thing with Leinster or any team that's looking to build on it, we talk about it with the Dubs and the football, you need a little bit of new blood coming in every year, and they don't really have it. I mean, Joe Tamani is the only guy who's kind of come in. Do you know what I mean?
You could argue James Lowe has.
Yeah, but he was there last season.
Started this season.
Yeah, fair enough. But the one change, really, or the big change, has been Felipe Contepomi coming in. As backs coach, you know.
Let's not make James Ryan old news just yet. Can we count him still as? I mean, we're already. He's already like
last year. You know, in terms of moving it on a little bit. But that's the point. They haven't infiltrated the dressing room with new players or said, right, we need two or three players to come in. Yeah. They're very comfortable with what they have. They still have the strength and depth. And it should be remembered as well. Somebody was saying, I think it might have been
Dallaglio about the age.
But as well as that, they have 27 internationals on the books and all of them are fit.
Well, Robert,
there's a great line by Peter Riley as well that, like, 18 of the 23 that are involved in Friday came through the Leinster Academy. So, like, it's just such a testament to their coaching system. And obviously, it's not just about Leo Cullen. It's a coaching and management team. There's so many people involved. And Contepomi has come in now as well. You've obviously, Stuart Lancaster made a big impact. But they're just, it's an astonishing. It's interesting. I don't know where I saw the reference, Brian O'Driscoll. You know, whether
Dallaglio.
Dallaglio, I think, saying that might well be better than a team that people thought of as a golden generation. It's just the success of golden generations now.
Dallaglio says, I'm not sure there's ever been as dazzling an array of talent in European club rugby as the starting 15. And he says, to think Sean McGrath, Jack McGrath, test lines in New Zealand last summer were on the bench, and obviously Dan Levy dropped out. And he said, maybe Toulon in their Galactico period are comparable, but he says that was an older team, that Toulon team. They were kind of established internationals. He says more than half of this Leinster team, Larmer, Ringrose, Henshaw, Lowe, McGrath, Conan, Van der Fleer, Ryan, Furlong are younger than 27. That doesn't include Dan Levy, who was a late withdrawal. And he says the ruthlessness reminded me of the All Blacks.
Yeah.
So it looks like we're seeing Leinster 2.0.
I would think when Sexton goes, I would say that Joey Carberry be coming back, like, there's effectively a loan
Do you think so?
I would think so.
Oh, we'll see about that. Well, I think Carberry's made all the right noises about wanting to be a kind of a club legend. I mean, he has to. He's down there.
He has to buy into it.
Oh, he has to. It was very interesting before the Leinster game as well. They did that video thing to see Munster, where they showed him around the Munster Museum.
Oh, yeah.
This is Munster and this is what it means. Brendan Foley and Dennis Leamy, I think, as well. Yeah. So I'm not sure about that. But
no,
I mean, look, you're right. I mean, the academy system that they have, you've Ross Byrne there on the bench. Kieran Frawley is there as well. You've Harry Byrne, Ross's younger brother. You've same with scrum halves coming through. I mean,
well, actually, you mentioned it, scrum halves. I'm glad someone did this. Neil Francis makes the point that Luke McGrath was amazing.
Mm.
I mean, scored 2 tries. He was on everyone's shoulder. He was fantastic. And he makes the point on McGrath, if I can just find it. I highlighted it. Oh, yeah. He says Luke McGrath, really good. Obviously, his pack gave him an armchair ride. But he says McGrath picked up an injury at the wrong time of the season last year. He missed the Grand Slam, missed out in selection for Australia. He says, Neil Francis, McGrath is a far superior player right now to Marmion and John Cooney.
Mm.
I think he still has an extra fraction of a second to find in his pass. I think that's been a criticism of McGrath in recent years. It's definitely improved, but I think it's still a bit of an issue. There's one point, I think, in the first half when they went through about 20 plus phases and it was under the posts and McGrath left to right passed Keane Healy and it just hung up in the air. I mean, you could see it. It was like it was caught by a wind. And Healy just went into contact and dropped at the same time. So that's just one thing. I take the point. I think he's all around. He's an excellent player. And Frano made the point about that tackle in the first half, which was superb as well. Just one little thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Because I find the contrast interesting because you have this about how sensational Leinster are, scoring 8 tries, etc. And the opposite page, you have Stephen Jones is scoring, getting boring, which I find intriguing because I started watching rugby in the 80s when every game was either 9-3 or 9-6. And you've got to try every 3 or 4 years, which is normally a prop being pushed over the line.
And does Jones make a good argument in your
opinion? I see his point. You know what screamed out at me when I was reading it was hurling. Because we've had this argument at hurling. And I think, you know, Stephen obviously is a love-hate kind of a writer, no matter what he writes. But I just found hurling screaming at me the whole time. Because I found this myself. And you make the argument and people kind of just dismiss it. Sure, there can't be too many scores, but what he's saying and what hurling, some people would say, Babs Keating among them, is that it's losing the intricacies. It's losing the
Well, you know, when you're reporting in a hurling game now, you're just noting scores, can't you? You've no time to kind of go into the other things that are going on, you know, the individual battles or the tactics. It's just score after score, your head down.
And he's made a good point on it. I mean, he goes through sections of the game, like the breakdown and scrums and everything, which are losing out because of this.
So a sense, I mean,
increase.
So he says recently Leicester ran up 37 points against Worcester, Bristol 40 points, Northampton, Wasps scored 31 against Exeter, Worcester scored 35 against Wasps, and all of these teams lost.
Mm.
He says, score 40 points and lose. Welcome to a gaudy sport. Something serious is happening to rugby, something potentially ghastly. I love Stephen Jones. tries are coming at such a rate where they go past the point where you treasure them and up to the point where they are cheapened and make you feel queasy. So he says, tries have risen in every season for the past 6 years in the Premiership Top 14 and Pro 14. And his argument is things like, I can still remember a game between Bath and Bristol in Bath where play hardly moved more than 5 yards for 20 minutes of scrummaging. But it was brilliant.
Yeah.
It simply scrambled the senses in its industrial beauty. But now the scrum is high up on the list of principles, is diminished. And he talks about how, you know, the referee instantly will scream, use it. They want the scrum out of the game,
well,
really.
Like,
and Brendan
Fanning
has a good piece about that as well.
I was
so
at the Harlequins game a few years ago, the Leinster, the Bloodgate game.
6-5, yeah.
It was 6-5, and it was really enjoyable game.
Great
you don't
game,
necessarily
yeah.
have to have 10 tries to enjoy a game.
It's interesting that this becomes an ongoing discussion around rugby now.
I have to say, it's not something that occurred to me until I actually read the article. And that was my first thought halfway through it. It was like, well, why is this an issue? And then he actually, like I say, he makes the point quite well. I don't think it's a serious issue, as serious as he's making out, but I definitely see where he's coming from. I can see what his thought process is.
Yeah, okay. We'll take a short ad break. We are coming back with a few bits and pieces. So there's a few bits on UFC. Joe Brawley's written a thumping kind of article, no pun intended, saying that UFC needs to be banned, and not because of Habib jumping into the crowd, frankly. He just watched UFC 229 and was fairly horrified by the whole thing. We have the Mail on Sunday in particular going big on the violence in the GAA. There's also an interesting piece on Katie Taylor's career and, frankly, how she can't get any good fights. A few other bits and pieces as well, so that's next. I was working in a busy bar yesterday after our customers involved in every play of the Champions Cup games, enthralled by it. There was little or no interest in Ireland-Denmark. Didn't even get asked for the volume, says Tommy in Cork. unthinkable, really.
Leave the volume on, turn the picture off.
Stick on the off-the-ball radio commentary, they said. Let us hear Nathan Murphy. So, yeah, that's a text in. We're with Brendan O'Brien and Kieran Cunningham looking at the Sunday papers. So we've touched on the football last night and the rugby. I guess UFC was always going to feature. This was a real chance for various writers to get their teeth into UFC 229. So we have Mark O'Toole here in the Sunday Business Post. Scenes of violence in Vegas only give MMA a black eye. We have Joe Callahan. Poisonous evening in Las Vegas is likely to be repeated, and that sits fine with Conor McGregor in the UFC. And then Joe Brawley, who watched it with his teenage son and his son's friends and was fairly horrified. And he said, no boundaries, no rules, violence is good. The time has come to call a halt to UFC's bloody freak show. So you would have to say the Mark O'Toole piece and Joe Callahan piece talk really about the whole Habib jumping into the crowd spectacle and the build-up to it with the bus. And Mark O'Toole makes the point that the new owners of the UFC, the WME IMG franchise, $4 billion then they paid for it in 2016, that has seen the organization pursue a profit before all else policy that makes naysayers' claims of illegitimacy hard to argue with, and references John McCain in the year 2000 saying it was human cockfighting, and how even McCain was won over as the UFC tried to put in more rules and strove for legitimacy. So Callahan and O'Toole there are talking about Habib jumping in and that whole circus, whereas actually Brawley in his piece I think is saying, look, Habib jumping into the crowd is a bit of a sideshow, it's a bit of a circus, it's WWE. Actually, what is striking him is what happened in the ring, or in the octagon, excuse me. And he says, frankly, it's horrific. So, I mean, to sum up his piece, because we'll get on to what the others are saying about the UFC. So to sum up his piece, I mean, he kicks off by talking about Django Unchained and DiCaprio having slaves fight for his amusement. And he says, in the early hours of Sunday morning, I thought of Tarantino's movie. I'd gone downstairs to see if my 13-year-old son and his half dozen excited friends had gone to bed after watching the McGregor fight. Hadn't started yet, so I made some chili tea and sat down amongst them to watch. And
what's chili tea?
I don't know. I don't know. Tony Ferguson fought Anthony Pettis. I saw this fight during the week. Now, it was incredibly bloody. I showed you by the picture I took on the TV of Ferguson on the ground. Pettis is above him, about to punch him. And he like turns to the sky and sticks out his tongue, Hakka style, as if he's about to eat the blood. It's fairly barbaric stuff. So he says, this one was even bloodier than the last. Pettis knocked Ferguson down heavily early on, recovered his senses, administered a shocking beating to Pettis, who had gashes all over his face so that his blood was all over Ferguson's body. These guys aren't just bleeding over each other, says the commentator, breathless with excitement. They're bleeding all over us. And look, it's Brawley, it's typically strong. Conor McGregor looks like a human dog and behaves like one, is one of the lines. I thought the beating he got was worse than anything else that happened during this disgusting night. How many shots can one man take? Roared the delighted commentator during the second round, he says. And he says, these human beings are animals just like Tarantino's fighters, and this is how animals are expected to behave. If they don't, then no one will be interested. And he criticizes, you know, Dana White, president of the UFC, said with a straight face on Sunday morning that this was a black day for our sport. Didn't buy that. He finally then says, they have placed a respectable veil over this savagery using the conventional language of sports punditry and the trappings of any normal sport. This could be done with fighting. Why not legitimize dog fighting? Call it the ultimate dogfighting championship, have highly trained vets there with expert veterinary first aiders, so a Dana White type can say the primary concern of all of us at UDFC is the welfare of the animals. He says, people thrill finally to this extreme violence. Putting people in a cage, dehumanizing them, watching them attack each other with everything they have brings us to somewhere primitive inside us. It's why the spectators in the Colosseum cheered as the sword was thrust home. It's not McGregor's fault, nor any of the fighters, nor the referees, nor the promoters, nor the audiences. The law permits it, and it shouldn't. It's time to ban UFC. It would be a sad day for Dana White, but maybe, just maybe, that is a price worth paying.
I have to say that the bit, there's about five or six paragraphs where he just, like you say, he describes what he saw. And it's the most striking, one of the most striking kind of descriptions of what it is to watch a UFC event that I've seen in paper. I don't think it'll change people's views one way or another. You either think it's barbaric or you think it's sport. But it really did strike me. It was a very good encapsulation of the events that happened and putting it into the context. There's other parts of the article I wouldn't be as keen on, but I just thought this is really striking. And I've been to a couple of them. I saw McGregor fight in New York. I saw him fight Brandao in the Point, whatever it was called at the time, 4 years ago. And I remember being in the press seats at that one in Dublin, and Kyle Pendred was fighting Mike King, an American guy. Pendred got the head beaten off him for at least one or two rounds. And then it all changed, and Pendred actually got him in a chokehold. And just happened to be that King was staring straight at the press seats, and I was watching there as his eyes rolled up through his head. And at that moment, I thought, oh my God, this isn't for me. Yeah,
but I think this is just very legitimate. Just to cut across you, Joe, but I think it is brutal, and it's hard to defend when you see scenes like that. But I've been going to boxing for years, and I've been at boxing bills where fighters have been seriously brain damaged for life. My brother was at a boxing night where a fighter was killed. Every single year, professional boxers die in the ring. Every single year. But it's been around for 120, 130 years, so it's become legitimized. You have like filmmakers like John Huston and Martin Scorsese made films about boxing. Bob Dylan wrote two songs about boxing, Who Killed Davy Moore in the Hurricane. Writers from Norman Mailer to Joyce Carol Oates to David Remnick to many others have written about boxing. And that's all helped to give it a legitimacy. But if you break boxing down, it's exactly as brutal. We know for a fact that it's on the stats we have so far, it's more dangerous than UFC, stroke MMA. So I think if you're looking, if you're putting MMA under the microscope, you do the same with boxing. I think it's just because MMA is a newer sport, it's a fresher sport. And I think the UFC is a big issue because the UFC is only about money. Like Joe Callan has a line there that a lot of the press were put up in the gods because they were selling tickets for 40 grand, the ringside seats. So they don't care about the media coverage. It's all about getting the money in. So it's all about selling it no matter what. And like I know Mark O'Toole is involved in MMA himself. So his take is interesting on it. And like my son has dyspraxia and he can't do team sports, but he took up Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Right.
And it's been really good for him.
Yeah.
Like the discipline and the techniques, and there's very good people involved in it. But I would make the distinction, as Mark does, between MMA and UFC.
Yeah. No, there's no doubt the UFC is all about money, 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 and very little else. Interestingly, so referring back to Brawley's overarching point, Mark in his piece in the Sunday Business Post Plus section talks about the attacks that often come in the Irish media and beyond. He says many of whom have never been to an MMA event, let alone a gym, and whose common jab at MMA is the phrase, "This is not a sport." He says they often paint MMA as something akin to pro wrestling or an unskilled, barbaric, no-holds-barred contest between fighters akin to a scrap between two thugs outside a chipper. And he says the reality is that this is a skilled sport requiring months of preparation for a fight between contestants with a high level of multiple martial arts who try to knit a strategy together in real time. And I'm always torn on that point because, you know, one of the great riposts from MMA people when, you know, this conversation first started on Liveline kind of 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago was, well, you just don't understand what you're seeing. And I've lost patience with that argument.
Yeah.
I think anyone is entitled to watch, particularly that Ferguson-Pettis fight and the blood, and say, I understand this. I do understand what I'm seeing. Now, Mark is absolutely right that the amount of skill and training that must go into being anyway decent at all these various disciplines. You know, it's not just like boxing. I mean, there's a million different things going on. McGregor's such an amazing striker and can kick, but then on the ground isn't as good. Like, the array of things you have to be good at is so vast. So you can appreciate all that, and you can still, I think, as lots of people do, look at it and just think, this is barbaric, it goes too far, there's too much blood, it's too dangerous, people die,
and it's
why do we do this?
And it's important, you know, the reason there is such scrutiny on it is it is a sport battling for legitimacy and acceptance. Like, it's only 2 years ago that the ban in New York was lifted. It had been banned for 20 years. It's still banned in France. Sport Ireland have never recognised it. And it's interesting that a lot of the opposition comes from other martial arts organisations. That's the case in Ireland and France. The main opposition to MMA being recognised comes from the Judo Federation.
Yeah.
That they don't think, they think it's unsafe and unregulated. And possibly there's a bit of jealousy there as well because it's getting the numbers that they're not getting.
There is a legacy issue and all that, because when it first started, it was like the only rule is there's no rules. Mm. And it was all like off we go. And Mark outlines very well, actually, I think in his piece, how they have changed from when John McCain said it was human cockfighting through to where we are now. Like Brawley in his piece says there are no rules. Like there are rules. You can't headbutt. You can't even elbow someone at certain angles. You can't do a 90 degree straight down elbow to the head. You can't knee someone in the head if they're lying down.
Yeah.
So there are rules. Obviously, it mightn't appear like that to lots of people watching, but there are rules. I mean, it's not going anywhere. There were 2.5 million pay-per-views. It broke all sorts of records. It's
but that's
than
McGregor,
ever.
Though. Like, yeah, totally. If you look at five of the six top pay-per-view events of all time, or McGregor, like when McGregor goes, where's the sport? That's a big
is
question.
Covered? Is that in Mark's piece, or it's in one of the
Joe
pieces?
Joe Callahan talks about it.
Yeah.
Where... just what a gift he was, that he was an English-speaking guy who managed to get them out of their little, you can call it a sporting ghetto, and into the
limelight. Like Khabib is never going to be a crossover star.
Khabib's got the wrong style, and he just doesn't have the personality for it.
And he's the wrong nationality for what they want. Yeah, you know,
exactly.
That's the
reality. So, I mean, the question is there, is this a sport that has hit its high point for now? I mean, where is the next superstar coming from? Ronda Rousey's gone as well. Even the guys who... preceded McGregor were not the type to thump their chests and break out of a very small marketplace. So it is a legitimate question.
Yeah, it is hard to watch. I mean, that Ferguson fight is grim. It was just, there was blood everywhere. At one point, they looked at each other and almost laughed at how ridiculous the other looked, realizing they looked pretty
similar. That's what strikes me
about
Brawley's piece, that his 13-year-old was watching with his friends, and they wouldn't be unusual. I'm sure there's loads of kids that age watching it.
And then I heard, God, sorry, his name escapes me terribly now, Mead footballer, I hate to use this example, he was the one who wasn't happy with Aidan O'Shea signing the autographs.
Oh, Bernard Flynn.
Heard Bernard Flynn. Sorry, Bernard, I know you're, not to define you by that, sorry, it was the first thing that popped into my head, but I heard him in a podcast.
One of the greatest players of the 90s.
I know, it's dreadful. That is dreadful.
That's all he ever did.
I apologise, sincerely, that is deeply unfair. You were far more than that. But Bernard was on talking about it on a podcast on the Irish Mirror do with Shane Stapleton, and he was talking about that same Ferguson fight that you have Brawley sitting there genuinely horrified by. I was somewhere in the middle. I was getting to a point where I was like, this is kind of hard to watch. My partner, she was saying, turn this off. Yeah. Bernard was sort of saying he loved it. He thought it was like, you know, a peak
a knees training session with McLeod and Jerry McAtee and
like
Lee Vernon.
Of human endurance and human courage and skill and bravery and all of these attributes that he thought, you know, and he did sort of quip. Now, I don't know what that says about me.
Yeah.
But that's unusual that Bernard thinks that, because there's a definite generation gap.
Generally
people over 40 or over maybe even over 35 have no time for it. And people under... And I often wonder, is it... a gap between people who grew up with even the video game culture that you're just growing up at a different time and had different means of entertainment as a kid, and even the wrestling to growing up at WWE and all that. And I'm not saying it's similar. It's like WWE is obviously fake, but it's just they have a different idea of what sport is, I think, a younger generation.
But you're right on a generational thing as well, and it's not just about what the fight is. It's everything that goes on around the fighting and what's acceptable. And obviously with McGregor and Khabib, there was a lot about, you know, religion brought into it, your father, this and that, everything else. And Joe Callahan in the Sunday Times, at the end of his piece, I think, makes a very good point about a guy called Colby Covington, who I'd never heard about.
Yeah.
A UFC interim middleweight champion and a Trump disciple who spends his days spouting right-wing slurs online. And this guy is clearly seeing what sells, and he clearly sees that hate sells, and this is going back into the McGregor thing, and I think it's all very difficult when you're writing a piece about drawing parallels with society and sport. It can sound very, very up your own backside, and it's a very, very hard thing to get a grip on, but I think Joe does it very well there, and he talks about, you know, how Covington is clued into this.
Yeah.
The more outrageous I am, and where do you draw the line with that?
Yeah.
It's the same inside the octagon that we were just talking about. Where is the line of acceptability?
Well, here's a question then, as we bring it to a close. So as Brawley points out, there is a primitive instinct in us. Lots of people are very enthralled by violence and blood. And Tommy Martin during the week wrote a great piece. Like, what did we all do at school when we heard there was a fight? Mm. We found out where the hell it was on and we got ourselves there.
Yeah.
So say it's banned. Mm. Say it's made illegal. Like, Brawley opens his piece by talking about Django Unchained.
Well, it goes underground then. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, and the distinct indifference with slavery is that these fighters are getting paid. They have a choice. And there is a degree of regulation. I know he's saying there's no rules. There are rules. Mm. Yeah. Mightn't like some of the rules for sure, but there are rules. So if you were to ban it, whilst acknowledging this primitive thirst for violence and that some people like fighting, then where does it go? It disappears. Yeah. Like, is cockfighting gone? Just because it's illegal in 50 states in America now?
Yeah.
No, it's not.
But when you ban anything, it goes underground because it's more dangerous. Like,
so what's the answer
then?
Even
with abortion, like backstreet abortion, it killed.
Absolutely. I think making it illegal, the cat's out of the bag. That ship has sailed. So what do you do? Do you try and even limit, bring in more rules and regulate the violence?
I think you need another body other than the UFC. I think you need a body whose primary motive or motivation is to look after the athletes and look after the sport, not their bank balance. Mm. And the UFC.
And do you feel queasy?
Not fit for purpose.
No, the UFC. I mean, the one thing that Mark O'Toole, Joe Callaghan, Joe Brawley all agree on is that the UFC, frankly, is a bit of a disgrace. And Dana White is. I mean, well, there was a great quote from Mark in his piece, which I hadn't seen. So, yes, he talks about Dana White the evening when he was given it the "all I'm just disappointed" routine. He says, Mark, the disgust that Dana had felt subsidized a few hours later when he gleefully declared the event had made more money than ever and had comfortably broken its pay-per-view record. So this is a quote from Dana White the next morning. The pay-per-view numbers are starting to roll in, so I'm in a much better mood than I was. Mm. We're way over 2 million, so I'm happy. And that is the truth.
Yeah.
But would you, I mean, if you kind of feel queasy about this, Ciarán, then should you not feel just as queasy about boxing if you're saying it's even more dangerous?
Well, I'm questioning boxing a lot at the moment. Let's be honest. No, not just because of the violence, but everything that's going around it at the moment. Like, you look at the guy who's been put in charge of the IABA, the international governing body, and who's been linked by the American authorities to the heroin trade. You know, they've come out in public and said this. Like, it's safe to say this, but you look at all that's going on.
You can see the flash of panic in my eyes.
There's got to be more now because you've got the MTK situation and the links, or supposed links there. So I've become very disillusioned with boxing anyway.
Yeah. But what about so the criminal elements around it are one thing, but what about two men in a ring with boxing gloves, the great art of boxing?
Yeah, well, so because we'll probably come to it in a while because of the Katie Taylor piece in the paper, but I saw the Katie documentary Ross Whittaker made, and it's brilliant, but the slow motion footage of the action in the ring, it really hammers home to you, like, how brutal a sport boxing is. You know, when you see the impact of the blows, and it's hard to defend that. And it goes back to the Tommy Martin's piece. There is a bloodlust in us. Mm. It's how you regulate that, because people do want to watch it. And people want to do it. Like, so people like Katie Taylor want to get into a ring.
Don't we have to be mature about that thirst in us? Like, you could say, I mean, you could make the same argument about legalizing prostitution. You could say, like, this is not going away. Yeah. So let's
and
just
the drugs
regulate
trade.
It.
Like, so this is something I think Philly McMahon has got a documentary on this about why drugs should be legalized. Because the supposed war on drugs doesn't work.
Doesn't that extend to UFC and boxing?
Just the whole thing on that then, and the same argument of rugby, is consenting adults can do what they want. If there's proper rules and structures in place, well, then you accept there's an element of risk. The problem is when you talk about under 18s and where does the responsibility lie with potentially putting them in harm's way, even with all these risks, because you're under 18, you're not in a position to make a properly informed choice for yourself. So, I mean, I take the point, you're talking about your son, Ciarán, as well. We all know sport, there's brilliant lessons to be learned. There's societal things that are brilliant with it. But at what point do you say, well, okay, well, am I setting my child or whatever down this road, and is that acceptable? Whether it's rugby or martial arts or boxing or MMA, I mean, you know, you're lighting a candle there and it burns down without you long after you've made that initial decision. So that's where the argument gets a little bit grey.
Yeah.
Consenting adults, fine. Rules are there. Yeah. You've drug tested. Everything's okay. It's when you bring kids into it.
Yeah, because it's funny, because just on it, because my son showed me a move and he said, you know, I know how to snap someone's spine. And I said, what? And he said, this move. And you think, you know, you're asking a kid to have a hell of a lot of control when you're showing them that moves. And, you know,
And is it difficult to snap someone's spine?
He doesn't know yet.
Well, I hope he never.
Did you ask him to show you the move?
Well, he kind of
I mean, let's not put it out. Let's not put it out there on the radio. Yeah, don't do a demonstration.
Might have done it on a teddy bear or something. Not on me. My back is patted.
Yeah, funny, because I remember being in school and WWE, a few of my mates inexplicably seemed to get into it around 15, 16. And honestly, lunch breaks for about a year became a nightmare. A nightmare. And lads were getting in the headlocks and doing all sorts and it's no crack.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. There we are. It's a conversation that's been going for about 10 years.
We're getting on to GA violence now.
Yeah, let's get on to the real violence. Let's talk about the real stuff. So, the Mail on Sunday in particular, I think, have gone very big on the GA violence and done some really good pieces. Philip Lanigan's piece I thought was very good. Michael Deignan and Mark O'Shea write about it. Shane McGrath's writing about it as well. Everybody, for a start, is in agreement that the GA have been incredibly quiet this week and should have said something, even if, you know, so Philip Lanigan touched on, Enda McGinley was on this show during the week, and Enda made very good points where he talked about we really are flirting with the danger of a one-punch fatality if this continues. He talked about how things like corporal punishment and drink driving are once acceptable. And even if these episodes are not on the rise and we're just seeing them more because of smartphones everywhere, even if that is the case, then even 1% of matches where this is happening, like fans getting involved, players, the whole team getting involved, then that is too much. And so Philip put these points, I think, to the GAA, and there was a sense that, well, we can't comment on open investigations or open disciplinary situations. But there was, right across the board, a sense of frustration that John Horn or somebody from the GAA has not come out after the last 2 months and said, we are going to get a grip on this.
It's not difficult. I mean, I'm speaking to rugby authorities as well about there's occasional things that go through disciplinary procedures. And all you have to do is preface what you're saying is, I'm not talking about any particular case, but in a general point. And then you talk about it. We obviously abhor this and anything with a, you know, a number of people and off the ball and something that goes in off the pitch, people coming onto the pitch. It's a general point. And I think it's a fair point that Philip makes and other people make today that it's not asking too much for the GAA leadership to come out and make that point. It's important that it does so. It's not, somebody made the point in the paper today, it's not going to solve anything, but it's a starting point. And this is clearly a cultural issue. And I still haven't been able to get my kids into the mini GA camps or whatever. They're still not showing an interest. So I don't know what goes on the ground. But is this going to need, somebody makes the point, it might be Michael Deignan or somebody today, is this going to need an absolutely zeroed in focus at Go Games level, that this is something that is drilled into the kids, that you literally need to drill in that low? Under sixes, under sevens, under eights. It can be done.
From a young age, it should be spelt out what is not acceptable and how potentially dangerous it is to throw a punch or a dig of a hurley, says Deignan. And he does make the point that it's mainly been football over the last few weeks, but he's fairly sure grim things happen at hurling as well. And a few people as well, Deignan mentions the John Milan example of him when he came into contact with Brian Murphy in 04, how he actually took the ban. You know, a few people make that point. So, you know, Shane McGrath says guilt is nothing more than an obstacle to be hurdled in the GAA. And well, Charlotte Burns has a great quote in Philip Lanigan's piece where he says, I'm part of the GAA disciplinary process at the DRA level. And he says, pick any of those incidents, say the Downpatrick Ballyholland one, for instance. He says, you're sitting on the Down CCC and you have that video and you say it's bad, terrible, no excuse. You look at it 10 times, you pick out a number, say you're going to investigate it, and then, you know, he says maybe the numbers are too grainy because the pictures aren't good enough, or he says, say you're going to find the clubs, they ask for a hearing, they're entitled to a hearing, he says the hearing finds against them, but then it turns out if the email has been sent in the wrong way or something like that, they win their hearing, or then they lose their hearing, then they go on to the DRA and we find ourselves adjudicating on it. He says there are so many throws of a dice in the disciplinary system that somebody somewhere will say they got this little detail wrong or that detail wrong. And they never get off on a, oh, actually, you didn't throw the punch. It's always a technicality.
But that's exactly it, because that is the culture in the GA, that people won't accept their punishment. You will appeal even when you know you're guilty. Like, you know, I remember talking to Eamon McGee about this one time, and he said, you know, he got banged to rights. He said, I know I did this wrong. And he said, they appealed. He said, I didn't want them to, but... You know, you're just told you appeal no matter what. You don't accept the punishment. And that's you know, I think you have to throw the club. Like, if you can't differentiate the numbers, say, in that Down incident, then you throw the clubs out. Like, I think that's the only way people would ever take seriously. If a club is thrown out of a championship for a year, and it's a severe punishment, but it would hammer the message home. But the problem is, as Charlotte points out, there are so many loopholes there for appeal that they need a complete new rule book that doesn't allow any room for appeal in those kind of situations. Because you look at the Sean Cox situation, which is desperately sad, and you look at so many other incidents of one-punch attacks and the consequences on those, somebody is going to get either get killed or get seriously maimed for life.
Because there's something else nobody talks about. They're bigger and they're stronger than ever,
yeah,
as well.
Because that's something else that I think could be relevant. I have no idea if it's relevant to any of the incidents that happened in recent weeks or in Las Vegas. But there was a survey last week, did you see this, on steroids? And one in five people between 15 and 34 in Ireland, not just athletes or people involved in sport, one in five of the entire population said they would take anabolic steroids. And the reason is body image and wanting to build themselves up. But a byproduct of steroid use is aggression, roid rage. And that is dangerous when you have a gym culture and people who might be on steroids. I have no idea if it happened any incident around here, but it is part of the culture now. Like there was nearly half a million seizures of illegal anabolics in Ireland last year. And that's gone up from, that nearly doubled in the year before, trebled from the year before that. Mm. So that is an issue nobody ever talks about.
Yeah, you wonder if anger is a part of it. Like Dignan even raises that point. He says, I watched a TV program the other night featuring a teacher who was frustrated trying to buy a house and move out of his parents' home because of the crazy prices in the rental market. He says, there's a lot of rage out there about everyday issues. It is possible to argue that society is now easier, and yet that isn't the experience for a lot of people. So
I'd be more attuned to the parish argument as well, as good and all as it has been for the GA. I think that's
the tribal element.
Clearly. I mean, we're all from different counties. We could all give, you know, umpteen examples of what we've seen and heard in the past, and we've seen it all over the country in the last couple
of weeks.
I
definitely found playing soccer, it was more about let's go out and try and play well.
Yeah.
You know, that was the added, let's go and play well, what are we going to do today? And the attitude in GA was, these are the lads from two towns over. Let's get into these. Mm. Yeah. Your family are out there.
Now, like some of the most vicious things ever, like which just maybe going back 80s really, some club games against our neighbouring club, and it was savage. Like it was pure hatred. And I remember an interview with Keith Barr a few years ago, and Keith Barr says, in the GA, the biggest bastard is always the fellow from the next parish.
Because Lanigan sort of says,
hatred there.
Philip Lanigan, blaming the GA is like blaming Donald Trump for climate change. It's not exactly the latter's fault. He's talking about the current incumbents. But they're going to have to do something really soon. And there's also, like Enda McGinley said, the time has come now to centralise this. So county boards, you can't trust them. And because there's a hypocrisy there whereby Tyrone will mete out bans for a club situation. And literally in the same week, appeal the Tyrone under-20s ban for that schmozzle a couple of weeks back. Yeah. There's too much self-serving going on.
Well, this is an issue in whether it's disciplinary or anti-doping or whatever, and we've seen this separation of the organising body from the disciplinary body in all sorts of sports. And it's only when you think of it really does make perfect sense. Yeah. I mean, there has to be, you know, there has to be justice and there has to be the perception of justice, and that should be separated. Now, you look at the amount of clubs at all levels in the GAA throughout the country, that is an enormous undertaking.
Mm. Yeah,
I mean, logistically, thousands of how matches. Do you even get your head around that?
I don't know.
It's a very difficult thing to do.
Here's a question then. Okay, so this is perfect fodder for newspapers and media discussions, and we sit here and all agree it's quite terrible and it will damage the GAA. At grassroots level, does anyone care? Or do people almost think, do you know what? Bit of argy-bargy, it's fine. Oh, there's a scrap, send it on to my WhatsApp,
I think there's
I'll
a mix.
Have a look.
There's very much a mixed reaction. Like if you go by social media, the amount of people that'll be given out about saying, oh, people shouldn't be filming this.
Yeah, sure.
Just basically want the Omerta and don't talk about it.
Do you think it's putting people off, putting their kids involved in the GAA? Do you actually think it is? I have to say, I don't. I think at grassroots, I don't think people make that connection, no. I don't know. I think in pubs around the country, if they're talking about it, did you see the bit?
Yeah, and like
I think there's always an element of that. It's like we talk about the UFC. It's the playground instinct. Yeah.
And it's every year this time of year. Once the All-Ireland ends, there's always these stories every single year. And what has changed? Nothing. Mm. Nothing has changed. It hasn't been confronted. So there's no will to confront it.
So that, well, like if you think things like drink driving, there's a social pressure now.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know if there's a social pressure in GAA clubs on the players who get involved in a melee.
Yeah, and also there's hypocrisy, because the amount of ex-players who would now have columns, you know, saying this is awful. And then they'd be telling yarns about some Romans. Butcher they used to play with to take the head off everybody you play with.
Yeah. But again, that's no, it.
It's you can't sentimentalize
so I'm asking,
that,
do we want to clean it up then?
Yeah, you do. It's a
but do we really?
I think you do, yeah.
I think, not talking about us here.
I think underneath all the joshing and everything, I mean, there has to be an understanding that you can kind of have a giggle over a pint at some video grab. But at the end of the day, like Enda McGinley says, all you need is one serious injury and then we all cop ourselves on. Mm. And that's why it comes back to, you're right, Kieran, you talk about the older generation and, well, in my day, this was this and men were men and everything else. But that's why it comes down to how do you eradicate all this beyond disciplinary structures and everything? It starts with the children.
Yeah.
That's what you do. I nearly said think of the kids there, but do you know what I mean? That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's where you get it in.
I just wonder, because in one of the videos where there was a real proper one off the pitch, the people videoing it, chatting behind the camera were saying, ah, here we go again. Jeez, aren't they gobshites? There was an element of, it's a bit of crack, it's not that big. Mm. No one was going, well, this is really shocking and dreadful, you know? And yet in the media, we put on that face, but I wonder.
But that's the horrible thing. I think it does need something
horrific
for people
to
wake up, something horrific, because people won't wake up to the reality of what could happen until that does happen. Hopefully it never will now.
We might just conclude then. I mean, there's plenty of good pieces and different things. Ben Thornley's done an interview with the
really
Class of 92 guy, and he's got a book out. I think we're chasing him down. We'll try and get him on the show as well, talking about basically career-ruining injury. But Beckham and Scholes and Neville all said he was the one in the Class of 92 who would have outdone them all, which is a scary thought.
Shades of Adrian Doherty, the lad from Strabane.
Yeah.
A horrific knee injury as well.
Yeah.
There's a couple of them around him.
But Katie Taylor features a very good piece in the Mail, because I think we wonder at times with Katie, well, what's going on? What's she up to? There's a bit of a distance there. I think she's not based here anymore. You don't know when her next fight is. I must confess, I didn't actually realise her next fight is in Boston very soon.
Yeah. Well, I think you will hear a lot about Katie in the next few weeks, because the documentary that directed by Ross Whittaker is getting a cinema release on October 26th, which, you know, is Friday week. There was a big cover interview with her in the Irish Times magazine yesterday, which is kind of kick-starting. And then she's fighting next week, top in the bill in Boston, which is a first for her. And
that's because Billy Joe Saunders is banned.
Yeah, absolutely.
Philip almost makes the point, it'll be interesting to see now how popular she is when she has to carry this on her
own. But it's funny, because you'll see, if you see the documentary, there's a lot of her coach, Ross Enemite, in it, who's quite an interesting character, but
he's the guy with the shaved head who pops up.
He was tweeting yesterday about, there's a highlights clip of Katie's fights on his YouTube page, on his Facebook page, I said over 9 million views. He says people keep bringing this up that nobody's interested. He said there's far more interest out there than people think. But there's one stage in the film, excuse me, and I think it's Brian Peters, her manager, Ross Enemite, and Katie herself are in a room, and they're talking about their frustration of getting the top fights. Because there are two or three champions out there that she wants to fight, like Delphine Persoon in particular. And then there's basically they're saying there's a load of boxers at kind of the lower tier. Then there's the three or four really good champions at the top, but the middle tier is pretty empty. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. And the main women are doing their best to avoid her until eventually they get a good enough offer that they can't turn down.
Yeah.
And then the others that she's going in against, you know, they just aren't able to give her enough of a fight. Like next week, Cindy Serrano, Katie's 25-1 on to win that fight. And she's been at those kind of odds for, I think, virtually at least 90% of her pro fights, which isn't her fault. She can only fight the ones whose the fighters are out there. And there are good fighters out there, but they're dodging her. And that's a bind she's in.
Mm. It's fascinating to see that, you know, she has been primed for this, you know, big role, and in many ways she's the anti-McGregor, because I mean she's so softly spoken.
She comes across really well in the film.
Does,
it's very interesting.
But she's very softly really well spoken, and she's not a natural salesperson, and yet here she is being thrust into the limelight with Billy Joe Saunders gone. I mean, the issue that she has in women's boxing isn't just women's boxing. I mean, we see it with a lot of women's sports at the elite level in terms of a lack of depth, because they are newer sports and because they are still building. I mean, we see it with rugby, we see it with Gaelic ladies football, we see it with camogie as well. There is a lack of depth in a lot of these sports, and it is an issue that will continue to be there until there is a greater number of kids who who do it. So it's not a unique situation.
Yeah, and it's actually a wider problem with boxing as well. Like James Tennyson is from Belfast. He's fighting for a world title next week. And how many people knew that? How many people have ever heard of James Tennyson? Yeah. He's fighting, and there was a time of an Irish fighting for a world title. It'd be the talk of the country for weeks beforehand.
Yeah. I didn't actually realise that. So Hearn is obviously with Taylor, and he's really trying to go big in the States now. He's, as Philip writes, or Mark Gallagher. Mm-hmm. He's got Bob Arum and Al Heyman in his crosshairs, and he's trying to flex his muscle in the States. So he's talking about becoming the top promoter in America within 6 years, and he has the backing of a $1 billion 8-year deal with DAZN.
Yeah.
Have you heard of DAZN?
No. So I have, but just from being around the KD camp.
Okay.
So they're very excited about this. She's very much part of this project.
Yeah. So DAZN is hoping to become basically the Spotify of sport, or the Netflix of sport, whereby they'll hoover up everything, and as part of that, they're going to have 16 cards annually. Matchroom will, and
there's streams, you know. It's video streaming service of boxing, basically. Yeah.
So is it just boxing they're focused on, as opposed to sport?
I think so. I think at the moment it's boxing.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be interesting when someone tries to do the sports version of that whole Spotify thing, you know.
Yeah. If it brings everything under one roof, I think a lot of people would be very happy with that.
But isn't it? We're at a bad point now, actually, for the customer, where it's so fractured, and you have to pay everybody. Yeah. Like, it's hard to escape the frustration last night that the Ireland match in Dublin is on Sky Sports and Virgin Media have all these other games, and Sky have nabbed this Ireland game, which frankly they don't care about, let's be honest. Scott Pinto and the lads aren't really digging too deep into things. I know they've Keith and Phil Babb there.
I'm
and
curious, did RT even bid for that though?
I don't know.
I'd be curious with that. You know, RT showed a documentary about turtles instead. a few people who were at the Viva might have preferred to watch.
What was more exciting? Because I saw a few tweets about the turtles being better. Right, Yeah, but that is a nuisance for the viewer. Like,
it is.
How are we at this point?
I don't subscribe to everything because I only subscribe to Sky Sports. I have Virgin Media because I'm on Virgin package.
But then you miss all the Champions Cup rugby. You missed Leinster. You missed Munster.
There are ways and means.
Okay, fair enough. But you know,
I don't subscribe to everything. Well, you can't.
A Spotify thing would be just dandy if we could pay our
Would.
A few quid a month and get that. Mm. That's us pretty much done. Is there anything else anyone wants to give a brief mention?
Another Mark Gallagher piece on Pat Burke.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very good. The first Irish born NBA player. Really good, and just going through a career that spanned stints in Russia, Turkey, Spain, America, played for Ireland. And interestingly, at the end of the piece, Pat is talking to Mark about the talent coming through in Ireland. He mentions a kind of seminal game just before the senior basketball teams were disbanded, where was it Denmark they were playing, Kieran? It was just somewhere around here.
Yeah, I think
they were
so.
One game away from the elite level of European national basketball, and they didn't make it. And then he says, look, everything fell off a cliff with the financial problems that the Basketball Association had. But he's back now, and he's been at camps in Gormanston, and he's just been so taken aback at the discipline of the kids, the team ethic of the kids, which he says you just don't see in America, and very impressed with the skill levels as well. So
yeah, that was the most interesting part, I thought, because he's talking about players were very encouraging of each other. There's no yelling or criticising, which you see a lot in America, because kids have been driven by their parents because they're obsessed with them being the new Steph Curry and making them rich, basically. But here he finds a more encouraging approach from parents and the kids. So some people would have argued with that. I know people say in sidelines here in soccer, etc., they can be a bit brutal, but it's interesting that he took that take.
Yeah.
As ever, a UFC chat generates lots of discussion. Gents, I think the point about boxing, MMA, martial arts, etc., an activity sport where the objective is to hurt your opponent is wrong. Rugby, GAA, etc., the objective is to put the ball down over the try line. Yes, there's an overly physical element to certain team ball sports, but regulation can deal with this. Not the case when your objective is to hurt your opponent, says Ocean in Greystones. Brian in Dublin, no ship has sailed. That's a weak, lazy argument.
Well, we talked relation to
what was that relation to?
UFC and the fact that it's
it's legitimized.
Yeah. Well, Brian, in fairness, no ship has sailed. That's a weak, lazy argument. There was about a 15-20 minute discussion. You can take one line out of it if you want. Good for you. Goes on to say, why not just give them weapons and let them at it? Well, obviously, no one's going to do that. If your argument is everyone has a deep down fascination with violence, that's not an argument, that's a fact. Then we should allow it. Pure rubbish, he says. MMA is not a sport, it's violence. You can hold someone down and repeatedly beat them around the head until they're unconscious. Disgusting activity. In other actual sports, the goal is not to hurt the opposition. Again, Brian, you've said absolutely nothing that wasn't said several times, several times over. Our point is, if you completely get rid of it, well, one, that's a difficult thing to do, and two, where does it go? Go somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, we can be sort of mature about this whole thing. I, you know, I understand people who look at this and think it's horrific. I think you both think it's fair. Neither of you like it.
Not a fan.
I don't particularly
like it. But like, it's, I know a lot of people are, but I've been in boxing matches and you're sprayed with blood. You know, if you're ringside, blood is spraying in it. There's a vapor spray of blood all through it.
Gents, thanks so much. Very enjoyable chat about various things. Joe. Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner and Kieran Cunningham from the Irish Daily Star. We'll take a short break.
Off the ball on News Talk.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.